everyone, and welcome to Food Navigator Asia's monthly podcast, the F&A Food and Beverage Trailblazers. This is a series where we speak to and get to know more about groundbreaking food and beverage firms in the Asia-Pacific region, as well as the people behind them and their stories. I am Pearlie, the editor of Food Navigator Asia, and as always, I am your host for this series. Joining me today is Mihir Prashad, founder and CEO of Umami Bioworks, a Singapore-based cultivated seafood company that is soon set to become one of the biggest market leaders in the region. And we'll find out a bit more about that in a second. But first, hello, Mihir. Welcome to the podcast. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks very much for your time. Pleasure to be here.
Really great to have you here. And I think first, we really need to discuss this merger between Umami and Shiok Meats, which are both obviously cultivated seafood leaders in their own right. Now you're joining forces here in Singapore. So please do tell us more about, you know, what this means for both companies moving forward. Are we going to see a different overarching name? Are we going to see a new operating model? What's going to be different moving forward?
The company will be retaining the Umami Bioworks name at the top level. And the Shiok Meats brand will be something that we look to find the best application of, whether it's in products or whether it's another way that we bring that to use, because I think it's quite an established brand and has a very nice ring to it in the Singaporean meaning. The Umami business model is having some early success. So in the early stages, continuing to work with large incumbents as a tech platform solutions provider, and basically offering additional species, crustaceans, for example, through that model is the first thing we will try, because we think now we have the relationship established that could be a really, really successful model. Between Shiok and Umami, there are some interesting things that have been developed that we could see a home as a individual product commercial plan for those, beyond just the manufacturing technology stack for the big food companies.
Of course. So could we say in the sense that, you know, Umami is acquiring Shiok, or is that not the way that you guys are putting this forward?
Yeah, I think we're saying it's a merger because it's a stock transaction. So in a lot of ways, we're combining under one entity. And since it's a stock transaction, the companies are technically merging, right? So that's the most accurate term. People may have their own perception of how they use those phrases, so I'll leave that up to each person to decide what they think applies. But in a sense, we're combining the assets of two companies. And while I'll be the CEO of the new entity going forward, the existing shareholders from Shiok will also be joining the cap table of the new entity, et cetera, et cetera. So it is really two entities coming together.
What exactly are the sorts of different technologies, different product expertise that, you know, each firm is bringing to the table as part of this merger? Are you seeing different roles that each company is going to be playing within the new Umami Bioworks?
I'm a big believer in trying to, when we bring new things together, to take kind of a first principles approach to evaluating the best new structure, and not sort of trying to just amalgamate them in a convenient way. Because in some ways, this gives us an opportunity to say what is the best path to take forward, ignoring, not assuming that what we did previously was the best way to do things. So we're now in the process of doing integration. It looks like what we're going to try to do is combine, like bring the cell line teams together, bring the media development teams together, process, et cetera, and then figure out, based on resources and structures, relative resource allocation, species by species, based on what our customers are telling us and what the science tells us is progressing. We are firmly convinced that crustaceans are an important part of the future of cultivated and seafood.
Yes.
And this is something that very little work has been done, I'll just say, on cell culture of crustaceans in general. It is a fraction of a percent of the money that's spent on cell culture overall. And there's a lot of exploratory work to be done. I think Shiok's team brings, and the Shiok IP brings, quite a lot of interesting insights that you won't find out published in the world on things that happen in cell culture of crustaceans that you don't see in other species. And some things they've learned about how to benefit from those, or how to avoid the ones we don't like very much. You know, and one example I can give is, like, crustaceans molt, right? So they have periods where they stop growing and they lose their exoskeleton and then start growing again. you actually see that happen in the cell culture. And you won't see it in animals that don't molt, right? So you don't see it in mammals, you don't see it in fish.
Yes.
So this is very unique biology that's not well studied. And the Shuck team has done pioneering work there. What we have to do now is try to figure out how to apply some of Umami's sort of machine learning and automated approaches that we apply to some of our cell culture and other processes to expedite the rate of learning going forward based on what they've learned so far.
I see.
You know, there's still a couple of key problems to solve in crustaceans. And the biggest one is, how do you get the cells to grow immortally? That's really, in our view, the core fundamental challenge of crustaceans. If you solve that problem, they look a lot like everything else. You can start to treat them like other cell lines.
Looking at that, you know, from that point of view, you did mention that, of course, you know, the Shuck IP coming in brings its own, all of these sort of benefits and new learnings and understandings. But I guess, you know, in that sense, of course, you know, we know that, you know, previously, Umami had a lot of, you know, public and private investment. Shuck had a lot of public and private investment. So does this merger means that, you know, your Umami BioWorks is taking over all of this from Shuck? You know, do you have to hit any deadlines or commitments that were made when it was still an independent entity? How will that sort of work moving forward?
We've been in very active dialogue with all of the investors who were Shuck investors previously and Shuck shareholders. Sharing our vision for what the future of the organization looks like and laying out priorities. I mean, I think from our sense, commitments to make to continue to do work on crustaceans, and that we do actually believe it's a core part of the thesis that underlies Umami, which is we want to work on endangered species that are hard to farm. And, you know, lobster and crab very clearly fit that criteria. But I think it's also It was pretty clear to them as well that we'll need time to digest and come up with an integrated go-to-market plan, and that we shouldn't treat it like we're taking two separate pipelines to market, but that it should become a properly integrated pipeline. And so, for example, Unagi is work that is ongoing.
Yeah.
We have relationships with the likes of Maruha Nichiro on working toward commercializing cultivated fish products in Japan. But I'll say we've had very strong market pull from the likes of Maruha and other strategics to explore crustaceans as well. The work to be done from us now is to actually go back to these customers and have a discussion about relative priorities, interest, and then to align that with the technical milestones to be achieved and come back with an integrated roadmap on exactly what we're going to prioritize and what we expect to deliver, let's say, 12 months and 24 months.
So we can say sort of like everything is still being planned up. Is that right?
At present, yes. I think we'll probably make some announcements in the coming month or two, or maybe a little bit after that as well, on guidance for some of these things.
I was also wondering, because, you know, there's also no doubt that, you know, the cultivated meat sector as a whole, cultivated meat, seafood, hit some sort of rocky hurdles in the recent months. You know, there was negative press about production and also the downward sort of like spin of investments. So I wanted to also find out from you first, you know, why, you know, choose to move forward with the merger at this rather challenging time, and also what your plans are, you know, moving forward to navigate these challenges, you know, regain and grow consumer and investor interest and trust.
Sure. I think at the risk of speaking in cliches, I think every challenge is also an opportunity, right? And I think Cultivated had a lot of very positive momentum, a lot of excitement, and the industry as a whole missed timelines, right? I mean, I think early promises were aggressive and maybe overly optimistic, and based on the fact that money would be available, and obviously as money has become less available or more expensive, it changes timelines. Part of what I think made us think about M&A in general was we were getting to the point where of being ready to put a dossier in for regulatory approval for novel foods.
Yes.
Had signed an early customer or two. And then we saw, okay, the market is really turning sour and sentiment is down. How do we think about the market will come back? You know, this is the trough of disillusionment. We'll see recovery on the backside. How good that recovery is and how long it is, TBD. But how do we position the company to be, in our words here, the partner of choice during this window and post? So how do we position ourselves to be the obvious company to choose if you want to get into Cultivated on the back end of this trough of disillusionment? And there were a couple of insights that came out of that intellectual exercise. The first was platform companies, which is what we're aiming to be, right, need to be able to bring multiple applications to market relatively quickly and show that they can leverage their core technology across multiple applications. So being able to go from a couple of species of fish to add crustaceans and to add a broader sense that we're not a fish company, we're actually sort of an ocean biology company as it applies to seafood. And that if we can crack crustaceans and fish, if somebody brings us octopus or somebody brings us scallops, we have a much higher degree of confidence we can solve those adjacent challenges. And the customer has that confidence. But the other idea was consolidation happens in pretty much every industry. I think it's unreasonable to assume that 150 separate entities will survive to commercial success in any industry in the beginning. And so then trying to say, how do we bolster our IP portfolio? How do we accelerate our path to solve some of these problems? And work through, and given how similar the core theses of Umami and Shiok are on problems to be solved, there's IP that we think can be applied not just to the crustaceans, but can also maybe be applied into our broader portfolio across fish. And so the idea is that the synergy together actually makes our platform more robust and helps plug a few gaps that we may have also. And time will tell if we successfully pull that off. But if we do, I think it puts us in a position to that a big industry incumbent can come in and say, I want to work with Umami, and today I'll work with them on tuna. And 2 years from now, I want to add lobster and crab. And a year after that, I want to add unagi. And that breadth justifies a big investment in building factories over the next 5 years.
So basically, it's looking at, you know, the longer term sort of thing. So, you know, I want to be attractive to sort of these industry players, not just, you know, from one or two or three types of seafood items, but, you know, many types across the board. I can fill a whole restaurant with all of my items.
Correct. And I think especially when you're talking to large companies, you know, right? I mean, Maruhani Chigo is a multi-billion dollar revenue business. The opportunity has to be big enough to justify the risk they're taking in being an early adopter. And I think for several years, Cultivated is going to be an early adopter business. And so we have to really help people to see what it could look like 10 years from now if they join us on the journey, and that it can be a big, stable part of their business. Because if we can't sell them on that vision, it's too risky for a lot of seafood companies that are quite traditionally minded.
Nicely put, very nicely put. So you did mention timelines earlier. So of course, a lot of the timelines have been sort of readjusted right now. Could I get some clarity from you regarding, you know, all of these timelines, and especially, you know, those that, what do you expect for Singapore in particular? What are we looking at in terms of commercialization, in terms of reaching mass price parity, in terms of going mainstream, that sort of thing?
So we think a lot about this on a product by product basis, because I think, you know, in seafood, there's such a wide range of prices. It's hard to talk about parity or generically. So if we look at our first product, will be unagi, which is a premium species. And it tends to be quite highly priced. Consumers will pay anywhere from $80 to $200 per kilogram for unagi, especially in the premium end. So we're targeting price parity on that first product. Coming out of a full pilot facility, which is actually being developed with Cell Agritech in Malaysia right now. Such a high price point product, we can do that at a smaller scale than we could do for a cheaper fish. But the way I think about this is actually there's a really good parallel if you look at Tesla, for example, right? Or some of these other electric vehicles. You start with a smaller volume, but premium product. And consumers in food know that certain fish are expensive. And so if you can meet parity there, then the next product down, in our case, is a grouper or a whitefish, much bigger market than unagi, but maybe 30-35% lower price point, but many more applications. So you can justify, I can make 10 different products with multiple customers and justify much bigger investments in facilities because of that larger potential, which helps to bring production costs down. And if we can prove consumers are willing to buy these products with unagi, then we can help to bring second generation grouper, third generation perhaps halibut or tuna, and we can get to these, I'll call them middle market species, where they're maybe in this $30 to $50 per kilogram range. that consumers are buying at restaurants or special occasions. They're not buying every day. I think with scale, you can get to price points that will match what consumers pay for salmon. But that will be a multi-year journey because you have to build sufficient capacity to be able to make a truly mass market product. And I think if we look at electric vehicles or solar panels, we can see that was a decade-long journey to get to the point where something became mass market. And we're in roughly similar territory here because you can only build factories so fast and you can only scale sort of consumer behavioral change and education so fast. Probably first products 2025, maybe second gen products late 26, early 27. It'll depend a little bit on factory construction timelines and how quickly we can help customers secure financing.
So we're not exactly completely like, you know, resetting the clock in the sense though, you know, another 10 years down the line, we're not looking at things like 2024 instead of, you know, previous estimations.
No, and I think the really important thing is to find commercial avenues to get products to market at the higher price points in the near term. Because I think pushing timelines out to hit lower price points shortchanges the process. There's a ton of work to do, even if you can only sell to 20 or 30 people a week in one Michelin star restaurant. If 2 months later you can add two more restaurants, that's progress. Mm-hmm. And there's work to do with consumer education. There's work to do with market acceptance that you can't shortchange. Like waiting 2 years in R&D to get to a cheaper product just delays that work. You can't do it when the product's not commercial.
On that note, I'd like to switch gears for a little bit and find out more about your own entrepreneurial journey. So I know that a good deal of your past experience has been in entrepreneurship. So the key question here would be, you know, why a cultivated seafood venture in particular when you could have picked so many other types of ventures?
My background's biochemistry and I studied and grew up in the US. So seafood was certainly not on my radar in the early part of my academic career or beyond that. I, right after university and actually in my last year, started a medical device company that in hindsight was probably ill-equipped to start given that it was a regulated, heavily regulated device company. And we were a couple of students and recent grads trying to build that. But then I had a chance to go and work at a venture studio as a very early employee. And a venture studio is sort of a place where you build companies as a business. And at the studio, I was kind of in charge of helping build what was at the time the aquaculture technology group. And so worked on half a dozen different technologies, starting to build companies around them. And many of them were aquaculture disease management or aquaculture farming management technology that were biotech enabled, given my background. Exposed me to a lot of the suppliers, the supply challenges with disease management, outbreaks, feed management. The traditional farming challenges. And what I realized was the things that had disillusioned me a little bit about working in the medical field, which was how long it took to make an impact and how much risk there was that you could spend a decade working on a drug that might fail at the last moment, were actually exactly the opposite in food. There were so few people working on trying to transform the food system. And yet I could see day to day how many problems farmers were increasingly facing trying to supply people food. And I think the overall view is fish farming is a very sustainable thing in many people's head, was a few years ago. And so they were not aware that we really were facing problems in being able to feed people 10 years out, 15 years out with current systems.
You know, based on all of your entrepreneurial experience, I was wondering, you know, what advice might you have for budding entrepreneurs, you know, even those looking to make a career change to enter specifically the cultivated seafood sector, you know, but have been hesitant maybe due to recent negative press, due to worries about, you know, investments, worries about money, all that sort of thing. What advice might you have for them?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to recognize that being in startups is going to be sort of lonely. Like you can't rely on outside sentiment because the media and what you see publicly is only a fraction of what's happening in an industry always. And it's usually not the most current information, right? Because some of that is proprietary. It's being kept behind closed doors. So if you have to really dive in and trust your own instincts, I think number one. The second thing I think is that it's really important before you make the jump, the leap into starting a venture, to have a hypothesis about why your approach is doing something that creates a unique advantage that you'll have that others didn't, especially in an industry like cultivated, where we've seen quite a few companies come and go or come and now start to struggle. But many, I think, can't articulate their point of advantage. And if you can't do that, especially nowadays, you won't raise money and you won't be able to sell a customer. Because why would they pick you over somebody who's 5 years more advanced if it sounds like you do exactly the same thing the same way?
Very well put. Okay, I want to look a little bit more specifically into Singapore. And I was wondering, at this point in time, do you still recommend Singapore as the place? You know, there's been a lot of hype over Singapore being the place for cultivated meat, cultivated seafood companies to enter, you know. So do you still recommend this for new companies, you know, and why so?
Maybe selfishly, I'll say no, because we like being, we like having the advantage of being here. I think it has pros and cons. So, you know, Singapore has a major advantage compared to being in a country like the US, maybe, where seafood consumption is much less prevalent, much narrower, in that you're much closer to the market, right? The growth in seafood is going to happen in this region. Singapore is a pretty easy place to do business. So that helps if you're coming to Singapore to start a company. But it has challenges because it's a small market. So, you know, if you're building in Singapore and you get an approval in Singapore, you can't sell to 300 million people. Whereas if you're in the US, you can. So that's something to think about in your strategy. Yes. And I think the other thing to think about now is also access to capital, especially with the industry being maybe turned away from the sweet spot for a lot of investors because they haven't seen it really deliver returns. And the best places in the world to get really early risk capital are, I think, still Silicon Valley and some of these places. It may not be the best place to build your business, but you're probably going to get more people willing to make an early bet when you have very little. And Singapore has some of that, but there are other places where if that's where you think your biggest risk is, you might have a better starting point to build your business. My point of view is you really want to play to your strengths as an entrepreneur. So if you think, I know the market and I just need access to customers, then build in a home where you have really good access to customers. Singapore is great for that. If you think, I need to raise money and that's going to be hard for me, but I'm good enough at being able to do this remotely that I can build a business from California and reach my customers in Asia, then make that bet. I think you kind of have to figure out what you think is going to be hardest for you to unlock and set yourself up for that.
So looking a little bit further forward, you know, what are you seeing for the future of cultivated meat and seafood, both here in Singapore and also for the wider APEC region?
One of the really exciting things is we're starting to see many more governments at least start exploring and trying to understand cultivated. The Korean government recently just announced that they're willing to accept applications and they have a formal process that they put forward. The Japanese government is actively in rulemaking mode right now. And we're having active conversations with a few other governments here in Southeast Asia. So that's very promising because that's a critical enabler for us to grow in the region. I hope that we'll see more startups in this region because the vast majority of cultivated companies have been US based. We've seen a growing number in Europe, but very, very few in Asia. And I think given that the population of Asia is about to be roughly half the world population, if we include India in the APAC conversation, that and a lot of the demand growth is going to come from this region. It's important to have companies that are being built with the needs of this region in mind. And I think the last thing that we see, right, for Singapore in particular, is I think we're going to see more approvals here in Singapore quite soon. I know SFA has their hands busy with quite a number of applications from many different companies. And we hope that we'll see the first seafood application soon. I think the world hasn't actually seen a seafood approval yet. And it's been a while. It's been several years since the first meat approvals. So I think that will be a really big boost, especially for the seafood companies to be able to say, here are the differences or similarities with meat. And now there's an established framework for both.
Okay, thank you so much, Mihir. That was very insightful, very interesting. So thank you so much for joining me today. It was wonderful to catch up with you.
Likewise, really appreciate your time.
Thank you. And also thank you everyone for listening to this podcast as well. And I wish everyone a great day ahead. For Food Navigator Asia, this is Pearlie signing out.